Random House Audio presents The Litigators by John Grisham. Read for you by Dennis Boutsakaris. Chapter 1. The law firm of Finley and Figg referred to itself as a boutique firm. This misnomer was inserted as often as possible into routine conversations, and it even appeared in print in some of the various schemes hatched by the partners to solicit business. When used properly, it implied that Finley and Figg was something above your average two-bit operation. Boutique, as in small, gifted, and expert in one specialized area. Boutique, as in pretty cool and chic, right down to the Frenchness of the word itself. Boutique, as in thoroughly happy to be small, selective, and prosperous. Except for its size, it was none of these things. Finley and Figg's scam was hustling injury cases, a daily grind that required little skill or creativity and would never be considered cool or sexy. Profits were as elusive as status. The firm was small because it couldn't afford to grow. It was selective only because no one wanted to work there, including the two men who owned it. Even its location suggested a monotonous life out in the bush leagues, with the Vietnamese massage parlor to its left and a lawnmower repair shop to its right. It was clear at a casual glance that Finley and Figg was not prospering. There was another boutique firm directly across the street, hated rivals, and more lawyers around the corner. In fact, the neighborhood was teeming with lawyers, some working alone, others in small firms, others still in versions of their own little boutiques. F&F's address was on Preston Avenue, a busy street filled with old bungalows now converted and used for all manner of commercial activity. There was retail, liquor, cleaners, massages, and professional, legal, dental, lawnmower repair, and culinary, enchiladas, baklava, and pizza to go. Oscar Finley had won the building in a lawsuit 20 years earlier. What the address lacked in prestige, it sort of made up for in location. Two doors away was the intersection of Preston, Beach, and 38th, a chaotic convergence of asphalt and traffic that guaranteed at least one good car wreck a week, and often more. F&F's annual overhead was covered by collisions that happened less than 100 yards away. Other law firms, boutique and otherwise, were often prowling the area in hopes of finding an available cheap bungalow from which their hungry lawyers could hear the actual squeal of tires and crunching of metal. With only two attorneys, partners, it was of course mandatory that one be declared the senior and the other the junior. The senior partner was Oscar Finley, age 62, a 30-year survivor of the bare-knuckle brand of law found on the tough streets of southwest Chicago. Oscar had once been a beat cop, but got himself terminated for cracking skulls. He almost went to jail, but instead had an awakening and went to college, then law school. When no firms would hire him, he hung out his own little shingle and started suing anyone who came near. 32 years later, he found it hard to believe that for 32 years he'd wasted his career suing for past due accounts receivable, fender benders, slip and falls, and quickie divorces. He was still married to his first wife, a terrifying woman he wanted to sue every day for his own divorce, but he couldn't afford it. After 32 years of lawyering, Oscar Finley couldn't afford much of anything. His junior partner, and Oscar was prone to say things like, "I'll get my junior partner to handle it," when trying to impress judges and other lawyers, and especially prospective clients, was Wally Figg, age 45. Wally fancied himself a hardball litigator, and his blustery ads promised all kinds of aggressive behavior. "We fight for your rights," and "insurance companies fear us," and "we mean business." Such ads could be seen on park benches, city transit buses, cabs, high school football programs, even telephone poles, though this violated several ordinances. The ads were not seen in two crucial markets, television and billboards. Wally and Oscar were still fighting over these. Oscar refused to spend the money. Both types were horribly expensive, and Wally was still scheming. His dream was to see his smiling face and slick head on television saying dreadful things about insurance companies, while promising huge settlements to injured folks wise enough to call his toll-free number. But Oscar wouldn't even pay for a billboard. Wally had one picked out, 6 blocks from the office at the corner of Beach and 32nd, high above the swarming traffic, on top of a 4-story tenement house. There was the most perfect billboard in all of metropolitan Chicago, currently hawking cheap lingerie, with a comely ad, Wally had to admit. The billboard had his name and face written all over it, but Oscar still refused. Wally's law degree came from the prestigious University of Chicago School of Law. Oscar picked his up at a now-defunct place that once offered courses at night. Both took the bar exam 3 times. Wally had 4 divorces under his belt. Oscar could only dream. Wally wanted the big case, the big score with millions of dollars in fees. Oscar wanted only 2 things, divorce and retirement. How the 2 men came to be partners in a converted house on Preston Avenue was another story. How they survived without choking each other was a daily mystery. Their referee was Rochelle Gibson, a robust black woman with attitude and savvy earned on the streets from which she came. Ms. Gibson handled the front, the phone, the reception, the prospective clients arriving with hope, and the disgruntled ones leaving in anger. The occasional typing, though her bosses had learned if they needed something typed, it was far simpler to do it themselves. The firm dog, and, most important, the constant bickering between Oscar and Wally. Years earlier, Ms. Gibson had been injured in a car wreck that was not her fault. She then compounded her troubles by hiring the law firm of Finley and Figg, though not by choice. 24 hours after the crash, bombed on Percocet and laden with splints and plaster casts, Ms. Gibson had awakened to the grinning, fleshy face of attorney Wallace Figg hovering over her hospital bed. He was wearing a set of aquamarine scrubs, had a stethoscope around his neck, and was doing a good job of impersonating a physician. Wally tricked her into signing a contract for legal representation, promised her the moon, sneaked out of the room as quietly as he'd sneaked in, then proceeded to butcher her case. She netted $40,000, which her husband drank and gambled away in a matter of weeks, which led to a divorce action filed by Oscar Finley. He also handled her bankruptcy. Ms. Gibson was not impressed with either lawyer and threatened to sue both for malpractice. This got their attention. They had been hit with similar lawsuits, and they worked hard to placate her. As her troubles multiplied, she became a fixture at the office, and with time, the three became comfortable with one another. Finley and Figg was a tough place for secretaries. The pay was low, the clients were generally unpleasant, the other lawyers on the phone were rude, the hours were long, but the worst part was dealing with the 2 partners. Oscar and Wally had tried the mature route, but the older gals couldn't handle the pressure. They had tried youth, but got themselves sued for sexual harassment when Wally couldn't keep his paws off a busty young thing. They settled out of court for $50,000 and got their names in the newspaper. Rochelle Gibson happened to be at the office one morning when the then-current secretary quit and stormed out. With the phone ringing and partners yelling, Ms. Gibson moved over to the front desk and calmed things down. Then she made a pot of coffee. She was back the next day and the next. 8 years later, she was still running the place. Her 2 sons were in prison. Wally had been their lawyer, though in all fairness, no one could have saved them. As teenagers, both boys kept Wally busy with their string of arrests on various drug charges. Their dealing got more involved, and Wally warned them repeatedly they were headed for prison or death. He said the same to Ms. Gibson, who had little control over the boys and often prayed for prison. When their crack ring got busted, they were sent away for 10 years. Wally got it reduced from 20 and received no gratitude from the boys. Ms. Gibson offered a tearful thanks. Through all their troubles, Wally never charged her a fee for his representation. Over the years, there had been many tears in Ms. Gibson's life, and they had often been shed in Wally's office with the door locked. He gave advice and tried to help when possible, but his greatest role was that of a listener. And with Wally's sloppy life, the tables could be turned quickly. When his last 2 marriages blew up, Ms. Gibson heard it all and offered encouragement. When his drinking picked up, she saw it clearly and was not afraid to confront him. Though they fought daily, their quarrels were always temporary and often contrived as a means of protecting turf. There were times at Finley and Figg when all 3 were snarling or sulking, and money was usually the cause. The market was simply overcrowded. There were too many lawyers loose on the streets. The last thing the firm needed was another one. Chapter 2. David Zink made it off the L train at the Quincy station in downtown Chicago, and he managed to shuffle down the steps that led to Wells Street. But something was going wrong with his feet. They were getting heavier and heavier, his steps slower and slower. He stopped at the corner of Wells and Adams and actually looked at his shoes for a clue. Nothing, just the same standard black leather lace-ups worn by every male lawyer in the firm, and a couple of the females as well. His breathing was labored, and in spite of the chill, he felt moisture in his armpits. He was 31 years old, certainly too young for a heart attack, and though he'd been exhausted for the past 5 years, he had learned to live with his fatigue, or so he thought. He turned a corner and looked at the Trust Tower, a glistening phallic monument jutting 1,000 feet upward into the clouds and fog. As he paused and looked up, his heart rate quickened, and he felt nauseous. Bodies touched him as they jostled by. He crossed Adams in a pack and plodded on. The atrium of the Trust Tower was tall and open, with plenty of marble and glass and incomprehensible sculpture designed to inspire and provide warmth, when in reality it seemed cold and forbidding, at least to David. Six escalators crisscrossed each other and hauled hordes of weary warriors up to their cubicles and offices. David tried, but his feet would not carry him to an escalator. Instead, he sat on a leather bench beside a pile of large painted rocks and tried to understand what was happening to him. People rushed by, grim-faced, hollow-eyed, stressed out already, and it was only 7:30 on this gloomy morning. A snap is certainly not a medical term. Experts use fancier language to describe the instant when a troubled person steps over the edge. Nonetheless, a snap is a real moment. It can happen in a split second, the result of a terribly traumatic event. Or it can be the final straw, the sad culmination of pressure that builds and builds until the mind and body must find a release. David Zink's snap was of the latter variety. After 5 years of savage labor with colleagues he loathed, something happened to David that morning as he sat by the painted rocks and watched the well-dressed zombies ride upward to yet another day of useless labor. He snapped. "Hey, Dave, you going up?" someone was saying. It was Al from Antitrust. David managed to smile and nod and mumble, then he stood and followed Al for some reason. Al was a step ahead as they got onto an escalator, and he was talking about last night's Blackhawks game. David kept nodding as they rose through the atrium. Below him and following behind were dozens of lonely figures in dark overcoats, other young lawyers rising, quiet and somber, much like pallbearers at a winter funeral. David and Al joined a group at a wall of elevators on the first level. As they waited, David listened to the hockey talk, but his head was spinning and he was nauseous again. They rushed onto an elevator and stood shoulder to shoulder with too many others. Silence. Al was quiet. No one spoke, no one made eye contact. David said to himself, "This is it. My last ride in this elevator. I swear." The elevator rocked and hummed, then stopped at the 80th floor, Rogan Rothberg territory. Three lawyers got off, three faces David had seen before but didn't know by name, which was not unusual because the firm had 600 lawyers on floors 70 through 100. Two more dark suits got off at 84. As they continued to rise, David began to sweat, then to hyperventilate. His tiny office was on the 93rd floor, and the closer he got, the more violently his heart pumped. More somber exits on 90 and 91, and with each stop, David felt weaker and weaker. Only three were left at 93, David, Al, and a large woman who was called Lurch behind her back. The elevator stopped, a bell chimed pleasantly, the door opened silently, and Lurch stepped off. Al stepped off. David refused to move. In fact, he couldn't move. Seconds passed. Al looked over his shoulder and said, "Hey, David, this is us, come on." No response from David, just the blank, hollow gaze of someone in another world. The door began to close, and Al jammed his briefcase in the opening. "David, you okay?" Al asked. "Sure," David mumbled as he managed to move forward. The door slid open, the bell chimed again. He was out of the elevator, looking around nervously as if he'd never before seen the place. In fact, he'd left it only 10 hours earlier. "You look pale," Al said. David's head was spinning. He heard Al's voice, but didn't comprehend what he was saying. Lurch was a few feet away, staring, puzzled, as if watching a car wreck. The elevator pinged again, a different sound, and the door began to close. Al said something else, even reached out a hand as if to help. Suddenly, David spun, and his leaden feet came to life. He bolted for the elevator and made a diving re-entry just as the door slammed shut. The last thing he heard from the outside was Al's panicked voice. When the elevator began its descent, David Zink started to laugh. The spinning and nausea were gone, the pressure on his chest vanished. He was doing it. He was leaving the sweatshop of Rogan Rothberg and saying farewell to a nightmare. He, David Zink, of all the thousands of miserable associates and junior partners in the tall buildings of downtown Chicago, he, and he alone, had found the spine to walk away that gloomy morning. He sat on the floor in the empty elevator, watching with a wide grin as the floor numbers zipped downward in bright red digital numbers, and he fought to control his thoughts. The people, one, his wife, a neglected woman who wanted to get pregnant but found it difficult because her husband was too tired for sex, two, his father, a prominent judge who had basically forced him to go to law school, and not just anywhere, but Harvard Law School, because that's where the judge had gone. Three, his grandfather, the family tyrant who'd built a mega firm from scratch in Kansas City and still put in 10 hours a day at the age of 82. And four, Roy Barton, his supervising partner, his boss, a prickish crank who yelled and cursed throughout the day and was perhaps the most miserable person David Zink had ever met. When he thought of Roy Barton, he laughed again. The elevator stopped at the 80th floor, and two secretaries started to enter. They paused momentarily when confronted with David sitting in a corner, briefcase at his side. Carefully, they stepped over his legs and waited for the door to close. "Are you okay?" one asked. "Fine," David answered. "And you?" There was no response. The secretaries stood rigid and quiet during the brief descent and hustled off at 77. When David was alone again, he was suddenly worried. What if they came after him? Al would no doubt go straight to Roy Barton and report that Zink had cracked up. What would Barton do? There was a huge meeting at 10 with an angry client, a big-shot CEO. In fact, as David would think about things later, the showdown was probably the tipping point that finally caused the snap. Roy Barton was not only an abrasive prick, but also a coward. He needed David Zink and others to hide behind when the CEO marched in with a long list of valid complaints. Roy might send security after him. Security was the usual contingent of aging uniformed door guards, but it was also an in-house spy ring that changed locks, videoed everything, moved in the shadows, and engaged in all manner of covert activities designed to keep the lawyers in line. David jumped to his feet, picked up his briefcase, and stared impatiently at the digital numbers blinking by. The elevator rocked gently as it fell through the center of the trust tower. When it stopped, David got off and darted to the escalators, which were still packed with sad folks moving silently upward. The descending escalators were unclogged, and David ran down one. Someone called out, "Hey, Dave, where are you going?" David smiled and waved in the general direction of the voice as if everything was under control. He strode past the painted rocks and bizarre sculpture, and he eased his way through a glass door. He was outside, and the air that had seemed so wet and dreary moments earlier now held the promise of a new beginning. He took a deep breath and looked around. Gotta keep moving. He began walking down LaSalle Street, quickly, afraid to look over his shoulder. Don't look suspicious. Be calm. This is now one of the most important days of your life, he told himself, so don't blow it. He couldn't go home because he was not ready for that confrontation. He couldn't walk the streets because he would bump into someone he knew. Where could he hide for a while, think about things, clear his head, make a plan? He checked his watch. 7:51, the perfect time for breakfast. Down an alley, he saw the red and green flashing neon sign of Abner's, and as he grew closer, he couldn't tell if it was a cafe or a bar. At the door, he glanced over his shoulder, made sure security was nowhere in sight, and entered the warm, dark world of Abner's. It was a bar. The booths along the right were empty. The chairs were sitting upside down on the tables, waiting for someone to clean the floor. Abner was behind the long, well-polished wooden counter with a smirk on his face, as if to ask, "What are you doing here?" "Are you open?" David asked. "Was the door locked?" Abner shot back. He wore a white apron and was drying a beer mug. He had thick, hairy forearms, and in spite of his gruff manner, he had the trusting face of a veteran bartender who'd heard it all before. "I guess not." David walked slowly to the bar, glanced to his right, and at the far end, saw a man who'd apparently passed out, still holding a drink. David removed his charcoal gray overcoat and hung it on the back of a stool. He took a seat, looked at the rows of liquor bottles aligned in front of him, took in the mirrors and beer taps and dozens of glasses Abner had arranged perfectly, and when he was settled, he said, "What do you recommend before 8 o'clock? Abner looked at the man with his head on the counter and said, "How about coffee?" "I've already had that. Do you serve breakfast?" "Yep, it's called the Bloody Mary. I'll take one." Rochelle Gibson lived in a subsidized apartment with her mother, one of her daughters, two of her grandchildren, varying combinations of nieces and nephews, and even an occasional cousin in need of shelter. To escape the chaos, she often fled to her workplace, though at times it was worse than home. She arrived at the office each day around 7:30, unlocked the place, fetched both newspapers from the porch, turned on the lights, adjusted the thermostat, made the coffee, and checked on AC, the firm dog. She hummed and sometimes sang softly as she went about her routine. Though she would never admit it to either of her bosses, she was quite proud to be a legal secretary, even in a place like Finley and Fig. When asked her job or profession, she was always quick to state, "Legal secretary." Never just a garden variety secretary, but a legal one. What she lacked in formal training, she made up for in experience. 8 years in the middle of a busy street practice had taught her a lot of law and even more about lawyers. AC was a mutt who lived at the office because no one there was willing to take him home. He belonged to the three, Rochelle, Oscar, and Wally, in equal shares, though virtually all of the responsibilities of his care fell upon Rochelle. He was a runaway who'd chosen FNF as his home several years earlier. Throughout the day, he slept on a small bed near Rochelle, and throughout the night, he roamed the office guarding the place. He was a passable watchdog whose bark had chased away burglars, vandals, and even several disgruntled clients. Rochelle fed him and filled his water bowl. From the small fridge in the kitchen, she removed a container of strawberry yogurt. When the coffee was ready, she poured herself a cup and arranged things just so on her desk, which she kept in immaculate order. It was glass and chrome, sturdy and impressive, the first thing clients saw when they walked through the front door. Oscar's office was somewhat tidy. Wally's was a landfill. They could hide their business behind closed doors, but Rochelle's was in plain view. She opened the Sun-Times and started with the front page. She read slowly, sipping her coffee, eating her yogurt, humming softly while AC snored behind her. Rochelle treasured these few quiet moments of the early morning. Before long, the phone would start, the lawyers would appear, and then, if they were lucky, clients would arrive, some with appointments, others without. To get away from his wife, Oscar Finley left home each morning at 7, but he seldom got to the office before 9. For 2 hours, he moved around the city, stopping by a police station where a cousin handled accident reports, dropping in to say hello to tow truck drivers and catch the latest gossip on the most recent car wrecks, drinking coffee with a man who owned 2 low-end funeral parlors, taking donuts to a fire station and chatting with the ambulance drivers, and occasionally making his rounds at his favorite hospitals, where he walked the busy halls casting a trained eye for those injured by the negligence of others. Oscar arrived at 9. With Wally, whose life was far less organized, one never knew. He could blow in at 7:30, fueled by caffeine and Red Bull, and ready to sue anyone who crossed him. Or he could drag in at 11, puffy-eyed, hungover, and soon hiding in his office. On this momentous day, however, Wally arrived a few minutes before 8 with a big smile and clear eyes. "Good morning, Miss Gibson," he said with conviction. "Good morning, Mr. Fig," she responded in similar fashion. At Finley and Fig, the atmosphere was always tense, with a fight just one comment away. Words were chosen carefully and received with scrutiny. The mundane early morning salutes were cautiously handled because they could be a setup for an attack. Even the use of Mr. and Ms. was contrived and loaded with history. Back when Rochelle had been only a client, Wally had made the mistake of referring to her as a girl. It had been something like, "Look, girl, I'm doing the best I can here." He certainly meant no harm by it, and her overreaction was uncalled for, but from that moment on, she insisted on being addressed as Ms. Gibson. She was slightly irritated because her solitude was interrupted. Wally spoke to AC and rubbed his head, and as he headed for the coffee, he asked, "Anything in the paper?" "No," she said, not wanting to discuss the news. "No surprise there," he said, the first shot of the day. She read the Sun-Times. He read the Tribune. Each considered the other's taste in news to be rather low. The second shot came moments later when Wally reappeared. "Who made the coffee?" he asked. She ignored this. "It's a bit weak, don't you think?" She slowly turned a page, then had some yogurt. Wally sipped loudly, smacked his lips, frowned as though swallowing vinegar, then picked up his newspaper and took a seat at the table. Before Oscar won the building in a lawsuit, someone had knocked out several of the walls downstairs near the front and created an open lobby area. Rochelle had her space on one side near the door, and a few feet away there were chairs for waiting clients and a long table that was once used somewhere for dining purposes. Over the years, the table had become the place where newspapers were read, coffee consumed, even depositions taken. Wally liked to kill time there because his office was such a pigsty. He flung open his Tribune with as much noise as possible. Rochelle ignored him and hummed away. A few minutes passed and the phone rang. Ms. Gibson seemed not to hear it. It rang again. After the third ring, Wally lowered his newspaper and said, "You want to get that, Ms. Gibson?" "No," she answered shortly. It rang a fourth time. "And why not?" he demanded. She ignored him. After the fifth ring, Wally threw down his newspaper, jumped to his feet, and headed for a phone on the wall near the copier. "I wouldn't get that if I were you," Ms. Gibson said. He stopped. "And why not?" "It's a bill collector." "How do you know?" Wally stared at the phone. Caller ID revealed, "Name unknown." "I just do. He calls this time every week." The phone went silent, and Wally returned to the table and his newspaper. He hid behind it, wondering which bill had not been paid, which supplier was irritated enough to call a law office and put the squeeze on lawyers. Rochelle knew, of course, because she kept the books and knew almost everything, but he preferred not to ask her. If he did, then they would soon be bickering over the bills and unpaid fees and lack of money in general, and this could easily spiral down into a heated discussion about overall strategies of the firm, its future, and the shortcomings of its partners. Neither wanted this. Abner took great pride in his Bloody Marys. He used precise amounts of tomato juice, vodka, horseradish, lemon, lime, Worcestershire sauce, pepper, Tabasco, and salt. He always added two green olives, then finished it with a stalk of celery. It had been a long time since David had enjoyed such a fine breakfast. After two of Abner's creations, consumed rapidly, he was grinning goofily and proud of his decision to chuck it all. The drunk at the end of the bar was snoring. There were no other customers. Abner was a man about his business, washing and drying cocktail glasses, taking inventory of his booze, and fiddling with the beer taps while offering commentary on a wide variety of subjects. David's phone finally rang. It was his secretary, Lana. "Oh, boy," he said. "Who is it?" Abner asked. "The office. A man's entitled to breakfast, isn't he?" David grinned again and said, "Hello." Lana said,
"David, where are you? It's 8:30.
"I have a watch, dear. I'm having breakfast."
"Are you okay? Word's out that you were last seen diving back into an elevator."
"Just a rumor, dear. Just a rumor."
"Good. What time will you be in? Roy Barton has already called."
"Let me finish breakfast, okay?"
"Sure. Just keep in touch."
David put down his phone, sucked hard on the straw, then announced, "I'll have another." Abner frowned and said, "You might want to pace yourself." "I am pacing myself." "Okay." Abner pulled down a clean glass and started mixing. "I take it you're not going to the office today?" "I am not. I quit. I'm walking away." "What type of office?" "Law. Rogan Rothberg. You know the outfit?" "Heard of it? Big firm, right?" 600 lawyers here in the Chicago office. Couple of thousand around the world.
currently in third place when it comes to size, fifth place in hours billed per lawyer, fourth place when looking at net profits per partner, second place when comparing associate salaries, and without question, first place when counting assholes per square foot. Sorry I asked. David picked up his phone and asked, "See this phone? You think I'm blind? This thing has ruled my life for the past 5 years. Can't go anywhere without it. Firm policy. Stays with me at all times. It's interrupted nice dinners and restaurants. It's dragged me out of the shower. It's woken me up at all hours of the night. On one occasion, it interrupted sex with my poor neglected wife. I was at a Cubs game last summer. Great seats, me and two buddies from college, top of the second inning, and this thing starts vibrating. It was Roy Barton. Have I told you about Roy Barton? Not yet. My supervising partner, a pernicious little bastard, 40 years old, warped ego, God's gift to the legal profession. Makes $1 million a year, but he'll never make enough. Works 15 hours a day, 7 days a week, because at Rogan Rothberg, all big men work nonstop. And Roy fancies himself a really big man. Nice guy, huh? I hate him. I hope I never see his face again." Abner slid the third Bloody Mary across the counter and said, "Looks like you're on the right track, pal. Cheers." Chapter 3. The phone rang again, and Rochelle decided to answer it. "The law firm of Finley and Figg," she said professionally. Wally did not look up from his newspaper. She listened for a moment, then said, "I'm sorry, but we do not handle real estate transactions." When Rochelle assumed her position 8 years earlier, the firm did in fact handle real estate transactions. However, she soon realized this type of work paid little and relied heavily upon the secretary with almost no effort from the lawyers. A quick study, she decided she disliked real estate. Because she controlled the phone, she screened all calls and the real estate section of Finley and Figg dried up. Oscar was outraged and then threatened to fire her, but backed down when she mentioned again that she might sue them for legal malpractice. Wally brokered a truce, but for weeks things were more tense than usual. Other specialties had been cast aside under her diligent screening. Criminal work was history. Rochelle didn't like it because she didn't like the clients. DUIs were okay because there were so many of them, they paid well, and they required almost no involvement on her part. Bankruptcy bit the dust for the same reason that real estate had: paltry fees and too much work for the secretary. Over the years, Rochelle had managed to streamline the firm's practice, and this was still causing problems. Oscar's theory, one that had kept him broke for over 30 years, was the firm should take everything that walked in the door, cast a wide net, then pick through the debris in the hope of finding a good injury case. Wally disagreed. He wanted the big kill. Though he was forced by the overhead to perform all sorts of mundane legal tasks, he was always dreaming of ways to strike gold. "Nice work," he said when she hung up. "I never liked real estate." She ignored this and returned to her newspaper. AC began a low growl. When they looked at him, he was standing on his small bed, nose tilted upward, tail straight, and pointing, eyes narrow with concentration. His growl grew louder. Then, on cue, the distant sound of an ambulance entered their solemn morning. Sirens never failed to excite Wally, and for a second or two, he froze as he skillfully analyzed it. Police, fire, or ambulance? That was always the first issue, and Wally could distinguish the three in a heartbeat. Sirens from fire trucks and police cars meant nothing and were quickly ignored, but a siren from an ambulance always quickened his pulse. "Ambulance," he said, then placed his newspaper on the table, stood, and casually walked to the front door. Rochelle also stood and walked to a window where she opened the blinds for a quick look. AC was still growling, and when Wally opened the door and stepped onto the front porch, the dog followed. Across the street, Vince Gulston exited his own little boutique and cast a hopeful look at the intersection of Beach and 38th. When he saw Wally, he flipped him the bird, and Wally quickly returned to the greeting. The ambulance came screaming down Beach, weaving and lurching its way through heavy traffic, honking angrily, causing more havoc and danger than whatever awaited it. Wally watched it until it was out of sight, then went inside. The newspaper reading continued with no further interruptions, no sirens, no phone calls from prospective clients or bill collectors.
At 9 a.m., the door opened, and the senior partner entered. As usual, Oscar wore a long, dark overcoat and carried a bulky black leather briefcase, as if he'd been laboring away throughout the night. He also carried his umbrella, as always, regardless of the weather or forecast. Oscar toiled far away from the big leagues, but he could at least look the part of a distinguished lawyer. Dark coats, dark suits, white shirts, and silk ties. His wife did the shopping and insisted that he look the part. Wally, on the other hand, wore whatever he could pull from the pile. "Morning," Oscar said gruffly at Miss Gibson's desk. "Good morning," she replied. "Anything in the newspaper?" Oscar was not interested in scores or floods or market reports or the latest from the Middle East. "A forklift operator got crushed in a plant out in Palos Heights," Miss Gibson responded promptly. It was part of their morning ritual. If she did not find an accident of some variety to brighten his morning, then his sour mood would only get worse. "I like it," he said. "Is he dead?" "Not yet." "Even better. Lots of pain and suffering. Make a note. I'll check it out later." Miss Gibson nodded as if the poor man were practically signed up as a new client. Of course, he was not. Nor would he be. Finley and Fig rarely got to the accident scene first. Chances were the forklift operator's wife was already being hounded by more aggressive lawyers, some of whom were known to offer cash and other goodies to get the family on board. Buoyed by this good news, Oscar walked over to the table and said, "Good morning." "Morning, Oscar," Wally said. "Any of our clients make the obituaries?" "I haven't got that far yet." "You should start with the obituaries." "Thank you, Oscar. Any more tips on how to read a newspaper?" Oscar was already walking away. Over his shoulder, he asked Miss Gibson, "What's on my calendar for today?" "The usual, divorces and drunks." "Divorces and drunks," Oscar mumbled to himself as he stepped into his office. "What I need is a good car wreck." He hung his overcoat on the back of the door, placed his umbrella in a rack by his desk, and began unpacking his briefcase. Wally was soon standing nearby, holding the newspaper.
"Does the name Chester Marino ring a bell?" he asked.
"Oh, bit. Age 57, wife, kids, grandkids, no cause given." Oscar scratched his close-cropped gray hair and said, "Maybe. Could have been a last will and testament.
They got him down at Van Easel and Sons. Visitation tonight. Service tomorrow. I'll snoop around and see what's up. If he's one of ours, you want to send flowers?"
"Not until you know the size of his estate."
"Good point."
Wally was still holding his newspaper.
"This taser thing is out of control, you know. Cops in Joliet are accused of tasering a 70-year-old man who went to Walmart to buy Sudafed for his sick grandchild. The pharmacist figured the old man was using the stuff for a meth lab, so the pharmacist, being a good citizen, called the cops. Turns out the cops all got themselves brand new tasers. So five of these clowns stopped the old man in the parking lot and taser his ass. Critical condition."
"So we're back doing taser law, are we, Wally?"
"Damn right we are. These are good cases, Oscar. We gotta get a few."
Oscar sat down and sighed heavily. "So, this week it's taser guns. Last week it was diaper rashes, big plans to sue the makers of Pampers because a few thousand babies have diaper rashes. Last month it was Chinese drywall.
They paid $4 billion already in the drywall class action."
"Yes, but we haven't seen any of it."
"That's my point, Oscar. We have got to get serious about these mass tort cases. This is where the money is, millions in fees paid by companies that make billions in profits."
The door was open and Rochelle was listening to every word, though this particular conversation was getting a bit stale. Wally was talking louder.
"We get us a few of these cases, then hook up with the mass tort specialists, give them a piece of the cake, then ride their coattails until they settle and we walk away with a truckload. It's easy money, Oscar."
"Diaper rashes?"
"Okay, that didn't work, but this taser thing is a gold mine."
"Another gold mine, Wally?"
"Yep, I'll prove it. You do that."
The drunk at the end of the bar had rallied somewhat. His head was up, his eyes were partially open, and Abner was serving him coffee and chatting away, all in an effort to convince the man it was time to leave. A teenager with a broom was sweeping the floor and arranging tables and chairs. The little pub was showing signs of life. With his brain coated with vodka, David stared at himself in the mirror and tried in vain to put things into perspective. One moment he was filled with excitement and proud of his bold escape from the death march at Rogan Rothberg. The next moment, he was fearful for his wife, his family, his future. The booze gave him courage, though, and he decided to keep drinking. His phone vibrated again. It was Lana at the office. "Oh?" he said quietly.
"David, where are you?"
"Just finishing breakfast, you know."
"David, you don't sound so good. Are you all right?"
"I'm fine, I'm fine."
A pause, then, "Are you drinking?"
"Of course not. It's only 9:30.
"Okay, whatever. Look, Roy Barton just left here, and he's in a rage. I've never heard such language, all kinds of threats."
"Tell Roy to kiss my ass."
"I beg your pardon?"
"You heard me. Tell Roy to kiss my ass."
"You're losing it, David. It's true, you're cracking up. I'm not surprised. I saw this coming. I knew it."
"I'm fine."
"You're not fine. You're drunk and you're cracking up."
"Okay, I may be drunk, but..."
"I think I hear Roy Barton again. What should I tell him?"
"To kiss my ass. Why don't you tell him, David? You have a phone. Give Mr. Barton a call." With that, she hung up. Abner was easing over, curious to get the scoop on this latest phone call. He was rubbing the wooden counter again for the third or fourth time since David had planted himself at the bar. "The office," David said, and Abner frowned as if this were bad news for everyone. "The aforementioned Roy Barton is looking for me, throwing things. Wish I could be a fly on the wall. Hope he has a stroke." Abner moved closer. "Say, I never caught your name." "David Zink." "A pleasure. Look, David, the cook just got here. You want something to eat? Maybe something loaded with grease, French fries, onion rings, a big thick burger?" "I want a double order of onion rings and a large bottle of ketchup." "Attaboy." Abner disappeared. David drained his latest Bloody Mary and went to look for the restroom. When he returned, he assumed his seat, checked the time, 9:28, and waited for the onion rings. He could smell them back there somewhere, sizzling in hot oil. The drunk to his far right was gulping coffee and struggling to keep his eyes open. The teenager was still sweeping floors and arranging furniture. The phone vibrated on the counter. It was his wife. David made no move to answer it. When the vibrating was over, he waited, then checked the voicemail. Helen's message was about what he expected.
"David, your office has called twice. Where are you? What are you doing? Everyone is very worried. Are you all right? Call me as soon as possible."
She was a doctoral student at Northwestern, and when he had kissed her goodbye that morning at 6:45, she was still under the covers. When he arrived home the night before at 10:05, they had dined on leftover lasagna in front of the television before he fell asleep on the sofa. Helen was 2 years older and wanted to get pregnant, something that was looking more and more unlikely given her husband's perpetual exhaustion. In the meantime, she was pursuing a PhD in art history and doing so at a leisurely pace. A soft beep, then a text message from her.
"Where are you? Are you okay? Please."
He preferred not to speak to her for several hours. He would be forced to admit he was cracking up, and she would insist he get professional help. Her father was a shrink, and her mother was a marriage counselor, and the entire family believed that all of life's problems and mysteries could be solved with a few hours in therapy. At the same time, though, he couldn't stand the thought that she was frantically worrying about his safety. He sent a text. "I'm fine. I had to leave the office for a while. I'll be okay. Please don't worry." She replied, "Where are you?" The onion rings arrived, a huge pile of golden brown circles covered in thick batter and grease, hot from the fryer. Abner placed them in front of David and said, "These are the best. How about a glass of water?"
"I was thinking about a pint of beer."
"You got it." Abner found a mug and stepped to the tap.
"My wife's looking for me now," David said.
"You got a wife?"
"Don't ask."
"Sorry. She's a great girl, wants a family and all, but we can't seem to get things started. I worked for 4,000 hours last year, can you believe it? 4,000 hours. I usually punch in at 7 in the morning and leave around 10 at night. That's a typical day, but it's not unusual to work past midnight. So when I get home, I crash. I think we had sex once last month. Hard to believe. I'm 31, she's 33. Both in our prime and wanting to get pregnant, and big boy here can't stay awake."
He opened the bottle of ketchup and unloaded a third of it. Abner placed a frosty pint of lager in front of him.
"At least you're making plenty of dough," Abner said.
David peeled off an onion ring, dipped it in ketchup, and stuffed it in his mouth.
"Oh, sure, they pay me.
Why would I subject myself to such abuse if I weren't getting paid?" David glanced around to make sure no one was listening. No one was there. He lowered his voice as he ground away on the onion ring and said,
"I'm a senior associate, 5 years in. My gross last year was $300K.
That's a lot of money, and since I don't have time to spend it, it's just piling up in the bank. But look at the math. I worked 4,000 hours, but billed only 3,000. 3,000 hours tops in the firm. The rest of it got lost in firm activities and pro bono work. Are you with me, Abner? You look bored."
"I'm listening. I've served lawyers before. I know how dull they are."
David took a long swig of lager and smacked his lips.
"I appreciate your bluntness. Just doing my job."
"The firm bills my time at $500 an hour, times 3,000. That's 1.5 mil for dear old Rogan Rothberg, and they pay me a measly $300K. Multiply that by 500 associates all doing pretty much the same thing, and you understand why law schools are packed with bright young students who think they want to join a big law firm and make it the partner and get rich. Are you bored, Abner?"
"Fascinating. You want an onion ring?"
"No, thanks." David stuffed another large one into his parched mouth, then washed it down with half a pint. There was a loud thud at the end of the bar. The drunk down there succumbed once again. His head was on the counter.
"Who's the guy?" David asked.
"His name's Eddie. His brother owns half of the place, so he runs a tab that never gets paid. I'm sick of the guy."
Abner eased away and spoke to Eddie, who didn't respond. Abner removed the coffee cup and wiped the counter around Eddie, then slowly made his way back to David.
"So you're walking away from 300 grand, Abner said. "What's the plan?"
David laughed, much too loud.
"A plan? Haven't got that far. 2 hours ago, I reported for work as always. Now I'm cracking up."
Another swig.
"My plan, Abner, is to sit here for a long time and try to analyze my crack up. Will you help me?"
"It's my job. I'll pay my tab.
Sounds like a deal. Another pint, please."
Chapter 4. After an hour or so of reading the newspaper, eating her yogurt, and enjoying her coffee, Rochelle Gibson reluctantly went to work. Her first task was to check the client register for one Chester Marino, now resting quietly in a modestly priced bronze casket at Van Easel & Son's funeral home. Oscar was right. The firm had prepared a last will and testament for Mr. Marino 6 years earlier. She found the thin file in the storage room next to the kitchen and took it to Wally, who was hard at work amid the debris on his desk. The office of Wallace T. Figg, attorney and counselor at law, had been a bedroom in the original scheme of things, but over the years, as walls and doors were reconfigured, the square footage had been expanded somewhat. It certainly gave no hint of once being a bedroom, but then it didn't much resemble an office either. It began at the door with walls no more than 12 feet apart, then dog-legged to the right to a larger space where Wally worked behind a 1950-style faux modern desk he'd snapped up at a fire sale. The desk was covered with stacks of manila files and used legal pads, and hundreds of phone message slips, and to anyone who didn't know better, including prospective clients, the desk gave the impression that the man behind it was extremely busy, maybe even important. As always, Ms. Gibson walked slowly toward the desk, careful not to upset the piles of thick law books and old files stacked along the route. She handed him the file and said,
"We did a will for Mr. Marino."
"Thanks. Any assets?"
"I didn't look," she said, already backtracking. She left without another word.
Wally opened the file. 6 years earlier, Mr. Marino was working as an auditor for the state of Illinois, earning $70,000 a year, living with his second wife and her two teenagers, and enjoying a quiet life in the suburbs. He had just paid off the mortgage on their home, which was their only significant asset. They had joint bank accounts, retirement funds, and few debts. The only interesting wrinkle was a collection of 300 baseball cards that Mr. Marino valued at $90,000. On page 4 of the file, there was a Xerox copy of a 1916 card of Shoeless Joe Jackson in a White Sox uniform,
and under it Oscar had written $75,000.
Oscar cared nothing for sports, and he had never mentioned this little oddity to Wally. Mr. Marino signed a simple will he could have prepared himself for free, but instead paid Finley and Fig $250 for the honors. As Wally read the will, he realized its only real purpose, since all other assets were jointly owned, was to make sure his two stepchildren didn't get their hands on his baseball card collection. Mr. Marino left it to his son, Lyle. On page 5, Oscar had scribbled, "Wife doesn't know about cards."
Wally estimated the value of the estate at somewhere in the $500,000 range, and under the probate scheme currently in place, the lawyer handling Mr. Marino's final affairs would earn about $5,000, unless there was a fight over the baseball cards. And Wally certainly hoped there would be. The probate would be painfully routine and take about 18 months. But if the heirs fought, then Wally could drag it out for 3 years and triple his fee. He did not like probate work, but it was far better than divorce and child custody. Probate paid the bills, and occasionally it led to additional fees. The fact that Finley and Fig prepared the will meant nothing when it was time to probate it. Any lawyer could do so, and Wally knew from his vast experience in the murky world of client solicitation that there were scores of hungry lawyers poring over obituaries and calculating fees. It was worth his time to check on Chester and lay claim to the legal work necessary in tidying up his affairs. It was certainly worth a drive-by at Van Easel & Sons, one of many funeral homes on his circuit. 3 months remained on the suspension of Wally's driver's license for drunken driving, but he drove nonetheless. He was careful, though, keeping to the streets near his home and office where he knew the cops. When he went to court downtown, he took the bus or the train. Van Easel & Sons was a few blocks outside his comfort zone, but he decided to roll the dice. If he got caught, he could probably talk his way out of trouble. If the police didn't budge, then he knew the judges. He used the back streets as much as possible and stayed away from the traffic. Mr. Van Easel and his three sons had been dead for many years, and as their funeral parlor passed from one owner to another, the business had declined, as had the loving and thoughtful service that was still advertised. Wally parked in the rear in an empty lot and walked through the front door as if he were there to pay his respects. It was almost 10 a.m. on a Wednesday morning, and for a few seconds he saw no one else. He paused in the lobby and looked at the visiting schedule. Chester was two doors down on the right in the second of three visiting rooms. To the left was a small chapel. A man with pasty skin, brown teeth, and a black suit approached and said, "Good morning. May I help you?" "Good morning, Mr. Graber," Wally said. "Oh, it's you again. Always a pleasure." Though Wally had once shaken hands with Mr. Graber, he made no effort to do so again. He wasn't sure, but he suspected him to be one of the morticians. He had always remembered the soft, chilly touch of his palm, and Mr. Graber kept his palms to himself as well. Each man disliked the other's profession.
"Mr. Marino was a client," Wally said gravely.
"His visitation is not until this evening," Graber said.
"Yes, I see that, but I'm leaving town this afternoon."
"Very well." He sort of waved in the direction of the viewing rooms.
"I don't suppose any other lawyers have stopped by," Wally said.
Graber snorted and rolled his eyes. "Who knows? I can't keep up with you people. We had a service last week for an illegal Mexican got himself pinned under a bulldozer, used the chapel there," he said, nodding at the chapel door. "We had more lawyers here than family members. Poor guy's never been so loved."
"How nice," Wally said.
He had attended the service last week. Finley and Fig did not get the case. "Thanks," he said, and walked away.
He passed the first viewing room, closed casket, no mourners. He stepped into the second, a dimly lit room, 20 feet by 20, with a casket along one wall and cheap chairs lining the others. Chester was sealed up, which pleased Wally. He put his hand on the casket as if fighting back tears. Just he and Chester sharing one last moment together. The routine here was to hang around for a few minutes and hope a family member or friend showed up. If not, then Wally would sign the register and leave his card with Graber with specific instructions to tell the family that Mr. Marino's lawyer stopped by to pay his respects. The firm would send flowers to the service and a letter to the widow.
And in a few days, Wally would call the woman and act as though she were somehow obligated to hire Finley and Fig because they had prepared the will. This worked about half the time. Wally was leaving when a young man entered the room. He was about 30, nice-looking, reasonably dressed with a jacket and tie. He looked at Wally with a great deal of skepticism, which was the way a lot of people initially viewed him, though this no longer bothered him. When two perfect strangers meet at a casket in an empty viewing room, the first words are always awkward. Wally finally managed to state his name, and the young man said, "Yes, well, that's my father. I'm Lyle Marino."
Ah, soon to be owner of the nice collection of baseball cards, but Wally could not mention this.
"Your father was a client of my law firm," Wally said. "We prepared his last will and testament. I'm very sorry."
"Thanks," Lyle said and seemed relieved. "I can't believe this. We went to the Blackhawks game last Saturday. Had a great time. Now he's gone."
"I'm very sorry. So it was sudden?"
"A heart attack." Lyle snapped his fingers and said, "Just like that. He was at work Monday morning at his desk. All of a sudden he started sweating and breathing hard, and then he just fell on the floor, dead."
"I'm very sorry, Lyle," Wally said, as if he'd known the young man forever. Lyle was patting the top of the casket and repeating,
"I just can't believe this."
Wally needed to fill in some blanks.
"Your parents divorced about 10 years ago, right?"
"Something like that."
"Is your mother still in the city?"
"Yes." Lyle wiped his eyes with the back of his hand.
"And your stepmother, are you close to her?"
"No, we don't speak. The divorce was ugly." Wally suppressed a smile. A feuding family would run up his fees.
"I'm sorry, her name is Millie."
"Right. Look, Lyle, I gotta run. Here's my card." Wally deftly whipped out a business card and handed it over.
"Chester was a great guy," Wally said. "Call us if we can help."
Lyle took the card and stuffed it into his pants pocket. He was staring blankly at the casket.
"I'm sorry, what's your name?"
"Fig, Wally Fig."
"And you're a lawyer?"
"Yes, Finley and Fig, a small boutique firm with lots of business in all major courts."
"And you knew my father?"
"Oh, yes, very well. He loved to collect baseball cards." Lyle took his hand off the casket and looked square into the shifty eyes of Wally Fig.
"You know what killed my father, Mr. Fig?"
"You said it was a heart attack."
"Right. You know what caused the heart attack?"
"Well, no." Lyle glanced at the door to make sure they were still alone. He glanced around the room to make sure no one could possibly be listening. He took a step closer so that his shoes were almost touching those of Wally, who by now was expecting to hear that old Chester had been murdered in some clever fashion. In a near whisper, Lyle asked, "Ever hear of a drug called Crayox?" There was a McDonald's in the shopping center next to Van Easel's. Wally bought 2 cups of coffee, and they huddled in a booth as far away from the counter as possible. Lyle had a stack of papers, articles pulled from the internet, and it was obvious he needed someone to talk to. Since his father's death 48 hours earlier, he had become obsessed with Crayox. The drug had been on the market for 6 years, and its sales had grown rapidly. In most cases, it lowered the cholesterol of obese people. Chester's weight had slowly climbed toward 300 pounds, and this had caused other increases, blood pressure and cholesterol, to name the most obvious. Lyle had hounded his father about his weight, but Chester couldn't stay away from the midnight ice cream. His way of handling the stress of the ugly divorce was to sit in the dark and knock out one pint after another of Ben and Jerry's. Once the weight was on, he couldn't get it off. His doctor prescribed Crayox a year earlier, and his cholesterol dropped dramatically. At the same time, he began complaining of an irregular heart rate and shortness of breath. He reported these to his doctor, who assured him there was nothing wrong. The dramatic dip in his cholesterol far outweighed any of these minor side effects. Crayox was made by Varick Labs, a New Jersey firm currently number 3 on Big Pharma's list of the world's 10 largest drug companies, annual sales of some $25 billion, and a long, ugly history of bruising battles with federal regulators and tort lawyers. "Varick makes $6 billion a year off Crayox," Lyle was saying as he sifted through research, "with an annual increase of 10%. Wally ignored his coffee as he scanned a report. He listened silently, though the wheels were turning so fast he was almost dizzy. "And here's the best part," Lyle said, picking up another sheet of paper.
Ever hear of a law firm called Zell and Potter? While he had never heard of Crayox, though at 240 pounds and with a slightly elevated cholesterol, he was mildly surprised his doctor had not mentioned the drug. Nor had he heard of Zell and Potter, but sensing they were major players in something important, he wasn't about to admit his ignorance. "I think so," he said, frowning, searching. "Big plaintiff's firm in Fort Lauderdale." "Yep. They filed suit in Florida last week against Varick, a huge lawsuit for wrongful deaths caused by Crayox. Here's the story in the Miami Herald." Wally scanned the story as his heart rate doubled. "I'm sure you heard about this lawsuit," Lyle said.
Wally was constantly amazed at the naivete of the average guy. Over 2 million lawsuits are filed in the United States each year, and poor Lyle here was thinking that Wally had noticed one filed in South Florida. "Yep, I've been watching this one," Wally said. "Does your firm handle cases like this?" Lyle asked so innocently. "It's our specialty," Wally said. "We cut our teeth on injury and death cases. I'd love to go after Varick Labs."
"You would? Have you ever sued them before?"
"No, but we've gone after most of the major drug companies."
"This is great. Then you're willing to take my dad's case?"
"Damn right I'll take it," Wally thought, but through years of experience he knew not to rush in, or at least not to seem overly optimistic.
"Let's just say the case has real potential. I'll need to confer with my senior partner, do some research, chat with the boys down at Zell and Potter, do my homework. Mass tort work is very complicated."
And it could also be insanely lucrative, which was Wally's primary thought at the moment.
"Thank you, Mr. Fig."
At 11:05, Abner became somewhat animated. He began watching the door as he continued shining martini glasses with his white towel. Eddie was awake again, sipping coffee, but still in another world. Finally, Abner said,
"Say, David, could you do me a favor?"
"Anything."
"Could you move 2 stools over? The one you got now is reserved at 11:00 each morning."
David looked to his right. There were 8 empty stools between him and Eddie. And to his left, there were 7 empty stools between him and the other end of the bar.
"Are you kidding?" David asked.
"Come on."
Abner grabbed his pint of beer, which was almost empty, replaced it with a full one, and situated everything 2 stools to the left. David slowly lifted himself up and followed his beer.
"What's the deal?" he asked.
"You'll see," Abner said, nodding at the door. There was no one else in the pub other than, of course, Eddie.
Minutes later, the door opened and an elderly Asian man appeared. He wore a dapper uniform, a bow tie, and a little driver's cap. He was helping a lady much older than himself. She walked with a cane, unassisted but with the driver hovering, and the two of them shuffled across the floor toward the bar.